This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, TV critic for the New York Daily News, sitting in for Terry Gross. Our guest, Richard Russo, won the Pulitzer Prize for Fiction for his best-selling novel Empire Falls. This weekend, HBO presents a two-part miniseries adaptation of that novel, written by Russo himself. In a moment, we'll listen to Terry's 2002 interview with Russo. Like most of Russo's fiction, Empire Falls is set in a small working-class town that's a shadow of what it was when its factories were open and vital. Those fictional towns are inspired by Gloversville, New York, where Russo grew up. His other novels include Mohawk, The Risk Pool, and Nobody's Fool, which was made into a well-received movie starring Paul Newman. Newman is such a fan of Russo's stories and sensibilities that he became an executive producer and the chief champion of a dramatic adaptation of Empire Falls. His instinct, his insistence, was that the novel, with its many characters and complex relationships, demanded to be told as a TV miniseries. He went to HBO, and HBO lapped it up. Empire Falls, directed by Fred Schapisi, is shot completely on location in Maine, and every river view, every weathered building, every overcast sky adds to the story's quiet credibility. So does its cast. There are over a dozen leading and supporting roles worthy of individual mention, because the actors portraying them do such a rich and textured job. Paul Newman has one of those roles, playing Max Roby, the irresponsible, grizzled father of Miles Roby. Miles, played by Ed Harris, is the star and central figure of Empire Falls. Miles is a shy, inwardly haunted man who runs the local grill. His dreams are modest. He wants to turn it into a more upscale bar and grill by getting a liquor license. But even those dreams are constantly and ruthlessly thwarted by the town matriarch, Francine Whiting, who owns the grill and has reasons for being so vindictive. Francine is played by Paul Newman's real-life wife, Joanne Woodward, who does a wonderful job. But so does everyone in Empire Falls, from Helen Hunt as Miles Roby's ex-wife to Aidan Quinn as his brother. And that extends to Robin Wright Penn and Philip Seymour Hoffman as key characters in flashbacks. Other familiar faces, such as Dennis Farina and Estelle Parsons, share screen time with lesser-known but equally impressive performers, like William Fichtner and Danielle Panabaker. It sounds like a laundry list, I know, but if you tune in to Empire Falls and spend time with these actors and characters, you'll come to know and care about them all. The town may be run down, but for actors and for viewers, it's a small slice of paradise. Here's Paul Newman and Ed Harris as father and son, sharing a meal at the son's diner. The son is afraid of heights. The father is afraid of commitment and has just returned from one of his impulsive trips to Key West.
You should let me help you paint that church. I was a house painter for 40 years, you know.
You keep forgetting, Dad. I'm painting the church for free.
That don't mean you can't pay me.
Yeah, it does, Dad. That's precisely what it means.
How am I supposed to get down to the Keys with no money?
You always managed when I was a kid. You disappeared every winter.
That's where the money was.
How come we never saw any of it?
Pay me to paint that church, I wouldn't have to feel worthless. I know law says old people gotta feel worthless. If you paid me, I might have some dignity.
The dignity ship sailed years ago, Dad. Decades.
Kind of hurt my feelings, but you can't.
Besides, anytime you feel like an infusion of dignity, come on down to the restaurant and wash dishes for a while.
That's your idea of dignity?
Mm-hmm.
Cooped up in a back room, no windows, minimum wage. Half of it goes to the government. Now, I would let you hire me if you let me work the grill. Ain't nothing to flipping burgers, and I like to talk to people.
I'd have to run you through the Hobart first, wash some of that stuff out of your beard.
I may be 70, but I can still climb like a monkey. I don't get scared up on a ladder like a little girl.
It works both ways, Dad. You can't hurt my feelings either.
Empire Falls, the TV miniseries, moves at its own pace and speaks in its own voice. Some critics have found it slow and meandering. I found it increasingly involving and thought Richard Russo adapted his novel thoughtfully and passionately. Terry spoke with Russo after he won his Pulitzer Prize for writing the novel Empire Falls.
Empire Falls is about a man in his 40s who has returned to his hometown, and there he runs a restaurant. It's not the work that he really wanted to do. It's not really where he wants to be living, but it's because basically of family commitments and wanting to bring up his daughter there that keeps him there. Do you want to read the opening paragraph for us?
Sure. The Empire Grill was long and low slung, with windows that ran its entire length. And since the building next door, a Rexall drugstore, had been condemned and razed, it was now possible to sit at the lunch counter and see straight down Empire Avenue all the way to the old textile mill and its adjacent shirt factory. Both had been abandoned now for the better part of two decades, though their dark, looming shapes at the foot of the avenue's gentle incline continued to draw the eye. Of course, nothing prevented the person from looking up Empire Avenue in the other direction, but Miles Roby, the proprietor of the restaurant and its eventual owner, he hoped, had long noted that his customers rarely did.
That's the opening paragraph of Richard Russo's Pulitzer Prize-winning novel, Empire Falls. Why did you want your main character to run a restaurant?
Well, he had to do something. I'm not sure. I wanted, you know, it could have been a restaurant. He could have been an insurance agent. He could have been doing anything, I suppose, that contrasted with the way that he had seen himself when he was young, which was perhaps as a college professor. He is a young man who went away from a small town to college and found out that it was really his world, and had looked forward to living the life of the mind. And so I wanted some sort of profession for him that would contrast with that. But as you know, probably from reading other novels of mine, I'm very fond of restaurants and diners, especially in small towns, because of my interest in community.
Why don't you describe the town you grew up in?
The town that I grew up in was Gloversville, and in upstate New York, and it was, as you would expect, a tannery town. My grandfather was a glove cutter. My father cut leather from time to time, did among myriad other jobs that he performed, and that I performed with him when I was growing up. But at the time when I was growing up, it was a one industry town that had already pretty much bottomed out in terms of that industry. It was like a lot of my towns, unlucky in that after World War II, women stopped wearing gloves at about the same time men stopped wearing hats. And when you're a town that doesn't do much besides glove cutting and a whole generation of women stop wearing gloves, you're in a little bit of trouble. And also, of course, the other thing that was happening, too, was that there were where gloves used to actually be cut in Gloversville. A lot of them now were being made overseas and in some cases actually shipped to Gloversville, all made except for maybe a button or something to be stitched on. And once that was done, they could claim that the glove was made in Gloversville. So there was it was the tag end of an era for a town. And once that industry began to go south, there wasn't an awful lot to replace it. And what did come in to replace it certainly wasn't of the same sort of jobs that had left.
Now, you left home. You went to college and you left home, so you didn't make your professional life in that kind of small town, at least not. You've taught in several places, probably some of those were small towns, but it wasn't the post-industrial small town that you grew up in.
Right.
But your characters always are there, or usually are there. Why have you kept your characters in that kind of town through the years?
Well, I'm not sure how many writers out there are giving voice to the kinds of people that I write about. When I was going to college and doing a lot of various kinds of construction work with my father, I think it was probably in between my junior and senior year. I was a laborer, but I was working with carpenters. And if you're a college kid and you're working with you know, laborers, carpenters, people like that in the summer, they ridicule and berate in a very good-natured way because, you know, they know that you're going away. You're going back to a world of books and ideas, and they're going to continue doing this very hard work that they've been doing for a long time. I liked these men a lot. And one of them that summer, I remember saying to me, I said, well, I'll see you next year or something. I'll see you soon. And he looked at me because, of course, that was a lie. And it was just a way of saying goodbye. And he looked at me and he said, no, I'm never going to see you again. You're never going to see me again. You're going to become educated and you're going to get a job somewhere teaching kids. And you're going to have a good, easy life, and you're going to forget about me and all the guys like me, and that'll be that. And he didn't say it in such a way that he thought that that was a bad thing. He said it in a way that suggested that was what it was about. That was what he hoped would happen. And in a way, I mean, what he said was partly true, because I did, you know, I finished that degree and then did another after that and educated myself out of the kind of very hard back-breaking work that I used to do in the summers with my dad. But he was wrong about forgetting these people. And I find myself in my imagination, for reasons that I don't entirely understand myself, going back into this world and giving voice to the kinds of people who I still have an enormous amount of respect for and also understanding of. I suspect that I understand the people in places like Empire Falls probably better than any other world that I have inhabited since then, and I've inhabited, you know, the world of academe and some other worlds. But this is the one that I know kind of way below the skin.
Let's get back to Terry's 2002 interview with author Richard Russo. When she spoke with him, he had just won the Pulitzer Prize for Empire Falls and released a new collection of short stories called The Whore's Child. The title story in The Whore's Child is set at a college, drawing in part on Russo's experiences teaching fiction writing at a series of universities. The story is told from the point of view of a professor who is surprised to find an elderly nun has gate-crashed his creative writing seminar. Her name is Sister Ursula. And here's Richard Russo reading from that story.
She appeared in class that first night and settled herself at the very center of the seminar, despite the fact that her name did not appear on my computer printout. Fiction writing classes are popular and invariably oversubscribed at most universities, and never more so than when the writer teaching it has recently published a book, as I had done the past spring. I'd gotten quite a lot of press on my recent book, my first in over a decade, and my fleeting celebrity might have explained Sister Ursula's presence in my classroom the first chilly evening of the fall semester, though she gave no indication of this, or that she recognized me as her neighbor. After class, I did explain why it would be highly unprofessional of me to allow her to remain in the advanced fiction workshop. After all, she freely admitted that she'd never attempted to write a story before, which, I explained, put her at an extreme disadvantage. My mistake was in not leaving the matter there. Instead, I went on. This is a storytelling class, sister. We're all liars here. The whole purpose of our enterprise is to become skilled in making things up, of substituting our own truth for the truth. In this class, we actually prefer a well-told lie, I concluded, certain that this would dissuade her. She patted my hand as you might the hand of a child. Never you mind, she assured me, adjusting her wimple for the journey home. My whole life has been a lie. I'm sure you don't mean that, I told her.
It's Richard Russo reading from his new collection of short stories, The Whore's Child. One of the interesting things about this story is that the nun who comes to the writing class has a truly terrible story to tell. She's been a nun her whole adult life, but she is the daughter of a prostitute. She never really knew her father, and there's a lot of mystery tied up in her feelings about her father and in who her father really was. she feels in some ways her whole life has been a lie, and she's trying to get this all down, but she's actually a terrible storyteller as a writer. You write in the story, her stories seem to be moving forward without exactly getting anywhere. It reminded the students of stories they'd heard other elderly people tell, tales that even the tellers eventually managed to forget the point of, narratives that would eventually peter out with the weak insistence that all these events really did happen. So I'm wondering what it's like as a teacher, as a former teacher now, to deal with students who have these really urgent stories to tell and can't quite express it in writing.
Yeah, I mean it can be excruciating for both them and the teacher. It can also be very funny. There's a lot of, despite the fact that Sister Ursula's story that she has to tell is a brutal and cruel one. The story as related in The Horse Child is also very funny because of the ways in which the students try to come to terms with the story that she is telling them. And it's much like that between teacher and student, because the student has very often a series of true things, a series of true events. So the first thing that the teacher has to do is honor the material by suggesting that, yes, there's absolutely nothing wrong with the material, and yes, a story can be made out of this. But you're going to have to turn this into something artful, which means that at some point or other in the story, what actually happened is going to fail you, because all that will ever be is a sequence of events, but it won't be a sequence of events that is in the section you read, that's actually going anywhere. It's proceeding without getting anywhere. And the teacher is really at this kind of the ground zero of storytelling and understanding and getting students to understand that what happened will not be sufficient to the story.
Did you ever feel that you inadvertently seriously wounded a student through your critique of their writing?
Oh, I'm sure of it. I can't think so much of a particular instance. I remember one case. I suppose at Colby College, it was a very, very smart young woman who had turned in a story that just wasn't very good. And it wasn't very good in a way that was approachable. I mean, you could explain to her at what level it was failing. But there was no way to do it with as much. Well, you just kind of had to say it. Here's what's wrong, and I know that she was terribly wounded by that. She was on the verge of tears leaving the class, and as often happens, those tears turn to rage the very next day in my office, and we went through the whole thing again. After she finished telling me what was wrong with me, but by the end of that office hour, we had managed to go back to the story and get it on track in a way that would work for her without compromising the thing that was most important to her in telling the story to begin with. So I mean, yeah, these, and I'm not really sure from a student's point of view whether the serious work that a real writer is going to do can be done without that kind of criticism, and sometimes even without that kind of pain that you have to come through.
Did you go through that kind of pain yourself from critiques?
Oh, you bet.
When you were a student, yeah.
Yeah, I know that from firsthand experience. I was not a quick study as a writing student. I had been reading literature seriously as a PhD student through what is the opposite end of the telescope, and when it came time for me to write, I had a lot of bad habits, a lot of bad expository habits. I wanted to both write the story and write the cliff notes of the story at the same time.
Don't tell what it all meant.
Yeah,
it symbolized.
Yeah. It was pretty ugly. And I had to be told that not just once but repeatedly, And yeah, it was very wounding, but absolutely necessary. And so yeah, I, as I say, I was not a quick study at all. And so I recognize this when I recognize the problems, many of them, when I see them in students, because most of the mistakes that are out there to be made, I made as an apprentice myself.
Well, Richard Russo, thank you so much for talking with us.
I enjoyed it, Terry, as always.
Oh, thanks.
Richard Russo speaking with Terry Gross in 2002. His best-selling novel, Empire Falls, is being dramatized this weekend as an HBO miniseries. Ed Harris, Paul Newman, Joanne Woodward, and Helen Hunt star, and Russo wrote the script.